In many respects, we have kept the best for last. Hopefully, you've enjoyed the conference so far, but as I and a few of others have indicated, there is a lot going on in terms of the changing structure of our private insurance market, and I could think of no better person to sort of lead us in this effort than Susan Dentzer, who has, you know, put together over the last several years some of the really best presentations through the journal that I've ever read in terms of the complexity of our changing market. So thank you for being with me this evening, and I will give the program over to you.
Thanks so much, Stu. So our last topic, of course, as you know, is the private insurance market and health insurance exchanges. And since we've spent already some time talking about the insurance market, I think this panel is probably going to tilt a bit towards exchanges. But as we know, these two subjects are very much interrelated. So I'm going to start with the political and the policy context, and then we will move to our excellent panelists who will take it from there. Just a quick word, of course, we know these have officially been renamed marketplaces by the federal government, so we're going to talk about health insurance marketplaces for the rest of the day. And there's a marketplace, just to give you a visual. Of course, that's exactly what they're going to look like,
right?
Yeah, exactly, much like that. So just to give you a few points about ground we hope to cover. Of course, we'll talk just briefly now about the brief evolutionary history of the concept and theory behind exchanges, and I mean really brief, because we want to get to what's happening now. The important perspective, I think, to keep in mind is that there were key design decisions made in the law that have really had enormous consequences now in terms of how the individual states and, of course, the federal government are now setting up both the exchange operation and also the effect on insurance rates. But so a lot of what we now view as going on and view as somewhat due to craziness is in fact due to exactly the way the law was written. Now, I'll also make the point that much of the public is completely clueless about all of this, as we know. And in terms of thinking about operational readiness of the exchanges now, I think we're at a critical point where it's time to distinguish between what I refer to as the parade of possible horribles from what might really happen. So what are the real concerns about implementation and standing up of the exchanges, and how do those differ from the kind of fear-mongering and breathless hyperventilating that is now going on, much of it, of course, in the news media, as much as I love my profession. So just to talk about... I think it was Laura Bowers who said that her advisor had told her that young people can never be funny, but old people can. So like medium people can be kind of funny. So I'll try to be kind of funny. Evolutionary history of exchanges. As we know, it has been long. It dates all the way back at least to the 1980s, when the theory of managed competition surfaced, Allen and Tobin and colleagues, and basically invented the idea of the health insurance purchasing cooperative, which was essentially just built on the simple notion that if you grouped, the larger you made the groups, the more you could spread the risks across the larger group, and that and the law of large numbers got you to health insurance purchasing cooperatives and out of the crazy individual and small group marketplace. Those, as we know, evolved into what became known as the alliances in the Clinton plan, the regional health alliances, of which there were going to be a couple hundred around the country. And then, of course, in 09 and beyond, it became the health insurance exchanges in ACA, the concept being that they would be either state or that there might be a single federal exchange, although people presumed that no state would ever turn down the possibility of having its own exchange, go figure. So the federal exchange would only be a backup exchange if it were necessary. And now we know that we're going to have marketplaces, state-based, partnership, and federally facilitated. So these new flavors of exchanges have had to evolve even since the law was signed to accommodate our new bizarre reality. Now, the theory, of course, behind this was that exchanges and insurance reforms together would dramatically improve coverage in the non-group and small group markets. That consumers would have new ability to comparison shop for price, that there would be new standards on cost sharing, would be standardized, so it would be much easier for consumers to compare one plan to another. But they would have some freedom to shop around vis-a-vis the networks that would be involved in the insurance plans, and some aspects of coverage that were not in the essential benefits package. Because what was in the essential benefits package would be more or less standardized. That, of course, is a theory. And then, of course, you know, the premiums were to be subsidized up to 4 times the federal poverty level. The subsidized coverage would act to bring more people into exchanges. And since we know that average tax subsidy is going to be $5,000, we can imagine that's going to be very ample incentive for many people to get into the exchanges. And then, of course, the administrative cost of coverage for individuals and small employers would, in theory, also be reduced. And in essence, also, the plans would, theoretically, because they would have larger market share, be in a better position to negotiate with providers. So the whole construct is really designed to really make competition come to life in the insurance market, and to the degree we believe that insurers can influence the underlying cost of health care, that would also prevail. Now, this is a map. I think Trish said earlier she showed a map that was already obsolete. This one I've tried to make semi-interactive to show its planned obsolescence. Basically, what we think we know is that 16 states in the District of Columbia are going to run their own exchanges. 7 states have been officially approved for partnership exchanges, and the rest will default to the federally facilitated exchange. That being said, we know that this is also still in flux. We have a state like Michigan where the governor wants to do a partnership, but the legislature hasn't appropriated the funds to do it because the same dynamic is playing out in Michigan as was described earlier in Ohio. In Illinois, for example, Illinois has decided that it's going to now have, at the moment, have a federally facilitated exchange or quasi-partnership model, but that it intends to evolve to become a state-based exchange in 2015. So even this map is changing as we speak, or potentially will change between now and October 1 when open enrollment begins, but beyond that, it's going to change after this year as states decide, many of them possibly will decide it's not such a bad idea to have a state-based exchange after all. Now, for all of the energy being devoted to this, I think it's important to keep in mind that the exchange-based coverage, even if it goes to the maximum expected, will still just be 9% of the total U.S. health insurance market. So I think that's an important perspective to keep in mind as we hyperventilate about what is going on with exchanges or not as of October 1. So it'll be an important additive to what is in place now in terms of health insurance, but it's not by any means going to be the whole of the equation, as we well know. Now, I mentioned the obvious that the design decisions made in the Affordable Care Act have an enormous influence now in terms of the complexity with which all of this is playing out. We have, again, the fully state-run exchanges. The states had the option of making them statewide, regional, or sub-state. So far, all of the state-based exchanges are going to be statewide, but that could shift over time. And they also have the choice whether to run the individual exchange and the so-called shop exchange together or separate those. As far as the federal-state partnership goes, the states have the option of just taking on the plan management functions, the insurance management functions, or just doing consumer assistance, or doing both, and we're seeing varieties of that as well. And then, of course, the federally facilitated exchanges outside of that. As far as the products sold in the exchanges, the states are required to offer a variety of certified health plans that have the state's version of the essential health benefits package. Essentially, faced with the decision of trying to decide for the entire country what should be in the essential benefits package and face the wrath of every provider group and other group across the country that would yell at it, the federal government in its bravery said, we will not decide this, we will send this to the states, and the states are all empowered now to pick their version of the essential benefits package from a group of options that were available in every state. And so every state has had now to pick its benchmark plan, which means now we will not have a national essential benefits package. We have 50 essential benefits packages. There are other interesting things that will be happening other than that element of variation. Also, there will be, we are still told, two multi-state plans for sale in each exchanges, although stay tuned because we don't actually know who those are going to be. And in addition, we have a number of states where co-ops have been formed, new entries into the insurance market. That the lid has come down on that. There will be no more than, I think there are 23 now, there will be no more than 23 because the federal funding has been taken away to create any new co-ops. But those will be new features in many markets, including, for example, in New York, where the Freelancers Union is now going to be on the exchange offering a co-op plan.
Allegedly,
yes, thank you. All right, well, we will see. Lots of experiment going on now in terms of how the states are governing the exchanges. Quasi-governmental approaches have been set up in a number of states. We heard earlier about the active purchasing model, or how much are the exchanges really going to be in there negotiating rates with plans and picking and choosing which plans can be on the exchange. And we've got the active purchaser model and the clearinghouse model, a la Utah, where essentially you set up the exchange and all comers can get onto it. So great variety there. Exchanges, as you heard earlier, also have to serve as the enrollment portals for Medicaid and for CHIP. And if a state elects to set one up, a basic health plan, which is the plan in the middle that's designed to deal with churning as people's incomes fluctuate and they move, say, between exchange coverage and Medicaid or vice versa. There's a lot of question now. In theory, this was supposed to be set up such that an individual could go on the state exchange website, enter some information, and be told instantly whether the person was eligible for private coverage and subsidies through the exchange or eligible for Medicaid. It's a real question now how many states will be able to have that real-time eligibility determination made. Certainly, in the coming open enrollment period, they may eventually all get to that, but probably only a handful of states will have real-time eligibility determinations available as of October. And just to give you a sense of how this is playing out in California, where the public employee unions are in control of the county health, the county Medicaid departments that enroll people in the state version of Medicaid, which is Medi-Cal. Essentially, we now know that there will be, at best, what is described as a warm handoff, so that if you go onto the state exchange website, you will be told if you're eligible for Medicaid, you can go back and go over to the Medi-Cal website, which is run by the state and the public employees who don't want any loss of jobs, and they want to continue having the in-place enrollment functions within the county structure. In the interest of time, I won't say much about the shop exchanges, but again, the states have the option of running them on their own or not. They have they can restrict the eligibility to employers with 50 or fewer workers until 2016, but in 2016, they must open them up to larger companies with 100 or fewer workers. And then after 2017, the states can open up their exchanges to employers with more than 100 workers. So this will be, too, a very important part of the experiment to watch, because if exchanges really do succeed, they will become an attractive option, particularly for those kind of mid-sized companies that may want to get out of the business of administering their own health insurance. I mentioned how all of this was supposed to be a result in streamlined enrollment and eligibility determinations. This, in theory, is the way it's supposed to work. You're supposed to be able to go on the portal. Basically, the federal government now, for the federally facilitated exchanges, has built this big data hub. So all of the federally facilitated exchanges will have their data flowing through that hub. And in addition, the IRS will be making determinations, as will Homeland Security, about the residency and citizenship requirements inherent in you being able to enroll and get exchange subsidies. How much does the public understand about any of this? Almost nothing, by and large. This is a Kaiser Family Foundation tracking poll in March. You can see that people were asked, does the Affordable Care Act have this or not? You can see 68% of people said 58%